League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast. I'm Ollie Lum and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. This week, we spoke to 220 marathoner, anthropologist and author, Michael Crawley. We spoke to Mike about his book, Out of Thin Air, the details of a trip he took to Ethiopia, where he lived and trained amongst world-class marathon runners for 15 months.
Yeah, welcome back, guys. Look, really enjoyed this episode. Something a little bit different, but we speak to Mike about training, Ethiopian culture, you know, Ethiopian diet, and how we as Westerners and the way we train, how we can adopt some of the Ethiopian methods to maybe bring us on, keep things interesting, and maybe eventually get as good as him. So look, enjoy the episode. So many insightful things that, you know, I learned. And if you haven't bought his book already, go and buy the book as well, Out of Thin Air by Michael Crawley. All right, take care.
Right, well, Mike, welcome to the podcast. Obviously, you're kind of a quality runner in your own right, and also the author of Out of Thin Air, and that's, I guess, what we want to talk to you a lot about today. But just for the listeners, could you just give us a brief like introduction to yourself, please?
To myself, yeah, sure. I'm an anthropologist, and now work at Durham University, but I've been a runner for a very long time, since I was maybe 13, 14. So I've kind of spent over half of my life as a relatively competitive runner, I suppose. Saw myself as pretty competitive on the Scottish sort of scene, I suppose, before I went over to Ethiopia. And then, found out that it's all relative with running, really, when I went over there and went from being one of the faster runners in Scotland to one of the slower ones in Ethiopia. But I've always kind of been interested in, I guess, kind of cultures of running. So I was interested in growing up in the Northeast, in what it was that made Gateshead Harriers so good in the 1980s, you know, what it was about that group of guys that meant that they were able to have, you know, that many people running 100 miles a week and you know, putting so many people in GB vests and on the Olympic podium and things like that. And so I think I took that interest from the Northeast into what I did in Ethiopia. So, yeah.
Yeah. 100%. We kind of just wanted to ask you why Ethiopia, like, first of all, and I guess how did the book come around? What was it about Ethiopia, I guess, compared to what we've seen before, maybe with other books and other studies around different running cultures?
Sure. Yeah. I was kind of intrigued by the fact that most of the time when we talk about runners from sort of Ethiopia and Kenya and Uganda, we refer to the East Africans. You know, as if it was a sort of fairly homogenous group of people, when in actual fact, you know, there are huge differences between Ethiopia and Kenya or Ethiopia and Uganda, and actually pretty pronounced differences within Ethiopia itself in terms of kind of language and different ethnic groups and things like that. So what I wanted to do was kind of get away from this idea of kind of conflating Ethiopia and Kenya as East Africa. And I also felt like a lot of the time when people talked about East Africa, actually they were talking about Kenya mainly, because obviously Kenya used to be a British colony. Lots of Kenyan athletes speak pretty good English. It's easier to go there and do research than it is to go to Ethiopia and have to kind of learn Amharic and things like that. So yeah, no one had written a book about Ethiopian running, really. People had written biographies of people like Abibi Bikila and figures like that, but no one had ever sort of looked at Ethiopian running in a kind of holistic way. So I just thought that was something that would be interesting, and also a way that I'd quite like to spend some time, you know, actually going to Ethiopia, spending a year there, and is a country that had always kind of intrigued me. So that's kind of how it came about, I guess.
I totally agree with that, Mike. Like, all the training programs and stuff you see, it all came from Kenya. And we would just assume that that's exactly what the Ugandans do, and that's what the Ethiopians do as well. So we would just assume they all do the same. But so you went out there to study them. And what surprised you most about the culture? Like, obviously, as we were just saying, it was only really Kenya who'd be studied before. So did you have like any sort of preconceptions and ideas in your head of what you might see? And was there anything which was completely different to what you thought like was going on out in Ethiopia, like training wise and culture wise?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of preconceptions that you get from sort of reading books about Kenyan running, or even just like listening to commentary on races, where people often focus on things like the fact that people used to run to school barefoot and things like that. And that, you know, sort of automatically transforms them into champion runners. And one of the things that that the coach of Kenenisa Bekele said to me in Bokoji was, you know, Bekele's house was across, was that side of the square, and the school was over there, like 30 meters away. So he wasn't running to and from school or anything. So those kinds of quite simplistic explanations of success, I think, were things that quite quickly went out the window. And I realized that in Ethiopia, actually, there's a huge amount of support for running from the government. So they, either from the government or from kind of organizations or businesses that are connected to the government that sponsor running teams, and sponsor a huge number of people to basically live and train full time as athletes. So they pay their rent for them, provide them with meals sometimes, give them a salary, so that there's actually hundreds of athletes who can describe themselves as full-time runners, which is just something that you wouldn't necessarily expect, I don't think, if you thought about Ethiopia and the reasons for success there. And then I suppose something that I was kind of expecting, having read about Kenya, but didn't realize kind of the extent to which it would be important, was this idea of kind of group training being, you know, hugely important. So the first morning I went for a run in Ethiopia, I kind of didn't know anyone at that stage. So I just went up into the forest and started running on my own. And I was kind of like physically grabbed by someone as they ran past in a group, in this line of athletes, and just kind of inserted into the group basically immediately. So, and they explained to me this stuff about how, I think he said, running alone is just for health. If you want to be changed and transformed as an athlete, you've got to run with other people. So that was kind of something that I learned sort of on the first day, really, that that running success is seen as this collective thing, you know, that you have to be embedded within a group in order to improve. And that's something that I think is quite different from the UK context, where you see most people running most of the time on their own. And I mean, when I come back, I slip back into that as well of training on my own, just because there aren't the kind of training groups at the level that there are in Ethiopia, in the UK, in most cities, unless you're in you know, a couple of places, Birmingham or Leeds or something like that. But yeah, those are kind of two of the main things, I think.
I think that was something which really resonated with me as well, like the surprise of, as a country or as a group, they all want to succeed. And it, like you were saying with the government backing as well, and me and Ollie were touching upon it, this leads quite nicely into the training programs. They all seem to do, it's almost like the whole country, or, you know, especially a large number of people, maybe they're split up slightly, but they all do the same training program. As in the UK, like you were saying, we all have different training programs or different schedules. We're on different timescales and stuff. And it's quite surprising that they are all able to buy into the same program.
Yeah, not necessarily exactly the same program, but the same sort of set of assumptions and things. So like everyone, no matter what level they're at, is doing a lot of running in a forest that we would look at maybe and say, that's actually not a particularly good place to be running.
Yeah.
And so there's that kind of idea that you need to be running on quite rough terrain a lot of the time, kind of weaving in and out of the trees and things like that, as a way of kind of building strength, and also making sure that you don't overtrain, because you're kind of deliberately using a kind of forest landscape in a way that means that you can't actually run fast on your easy days. So they all, there's for everyone, I think, this idea that you need to run your hard days really hard and your easy days really easy. And then broadly, I think whilst the sessions might be slightly different, there is this kind of normal pattern of doing kind of one run on the road per week, and only one, and then one speed session, and then a kind of a long run on like rough road, they call it, or Korakonchi in Amharic. So yeah, there is kind of this pretty accepted set of training approaches that people just know work, and they will follow them more or less. Yeah. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that. And I kind of just wanted to touch a bit more on, you discussed the locations there. And it seemed that it was almost this idea that every run had a purpose and people were willing to travel across the city. And you kind of mentioned in the book about people staying in beds with other athletes the night before just to get to a certain hill, yeah. Things like that. How different is that to the UK? And there's almost this kind of, you know, I think you kind of mentioned it as like mystical or perhaps like religious, like, view on some of these training locations. Like how much value did they really put on that?
Yeah, I think we often would say, we would look at a training session and think, well, that's the same session regardless of where you do it necessarily. But in Ethiopia, because I think they do have access to this wider range of environments, I think within an hour's drive of where they live. Mm-hmm. But there's this real sense that it's almost the place that you do a training session that's the most important thing. More important almost than what you actually do. So they would go to Intoto, the mountain sometimes, which you could run up to about 3,400 meters above sea level on Intoto. So you're kind of really, really high.
Yeah.
And they would go up there because they said, you know, you can run at 6 minutes per kilometer up here and still get really fit because the air is just so thin. And then they would, on other days, they would take the bus down to a place called Akaki where they could run down to as low as about 1,800 meters above sea level. So, wow. Down there, it's probably 15 degrees warmer than on Intoto. You've got that kind of warmth is associated with being able to run fast and do speed sessions really effectively. So yeah, they're able to kind of draw upon these different places, and it's sort of almost like how they can position themselves in relation to these different places is basically the most important thing to think about. In terms of their kind of training week. And then, as you said, yeah, there's these kind of mystical almost connotations to do with like how many churches there are in Intoto and feeling kind of close to that. Most of the runners are Orthodox Christians. They feel that there's a kind of particular kind of power that's kind of environmental, but also kind of spiritual to that mountain. Yeah, the belief in place is really, really pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mike, you're running yourself. You've run, is it a 2:19 marathon or a 2:20 marathon?
It depends. 2:19 in Manchester when it was short, 2:20 in Frankfurt when it was the right length.
Yeah, so there or thereabouts. But I just want to talk about like the idea of jogging, because obviously like we as like Europeans, like we read this stuff in Kenya and Ethiopia that they're jogging. And they do take their easy days easy, there's no doubt about it. But like you've just said there, they're able to jog at 10,000 feet or 3,400 meters. That's why they're jogging, you know. And is there a thing in the UK that we've started to jog, but we're at sea level, like we're not getting the same gains?
That's a good question.
You see what I'm saying? Should we, because it used to be a lot of sort of like, you look at programs like Ovette and stuff used to do, it was a lot of steady running, which was almost like the foundation of his success. And in the UK, I feel like we're just slowly being like, well, the Kenyans jog on their easy days or the Ethiopians jog on their easy days. But they do have 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 feet of elevation.
Yeah.
So they're still getting the physical gains. If we go and do 7 minute miles or 8 minute miles, is it a bit of a waste of time? What's your opinion?
That's a really good question, but I suppose you've got to remember that most of the guys that I knew had never been below, you know, 2,000 meters above sea level until they went to a race abroad. So
crazy.
For them, it doesn't feel like they're at, you know, it doesn't feel like they're at altitude when they're at altitude. So I guess it is slightly different. But then when I come back, you know, I'm living in the Northeast again now. I'm coached by the coach I've had since I was 15, who ran for Gateshead in the 80s. He complains if my steady runs are slower than, you know, that was almost 6 minute miling, because that's what they used to do back then. So I guess it's, you know, different things do work for different people. And I can see where you're coming from. But I think, you know, probably the three sessions that they would do in a week are quite a lot harder than what most distance runners are doing here. And therefore, I think if you're training that hard on your three runs, then you need to be running pretty easy on your easy days. So like the Friday run on asphalt is often something like 4K hard and then 1K float, but it was like 4K at 3 minutes per kilometer, and then wow. easy K is like 3:30, and they'll do that for 25K, and it's just it's really intense. So then the next day, they I think you basically just need to jog really slow, otherwise you're not gonna survive it basically. Yeah. So they referred to training as adaptation. That was the word they used in English, and it was this idea that you needed that anyone could really do it, but you had to kind of gradually give yourself time, basically be patient and get there gradually.
I think that's what I loved about like the, you know, when you highlight some of the sessions in the book and stuff, it's just a very simplistic approach. The sessions aren't complicated. Like you say, they've gone and done 4K, a 25K run with a K flow. You know, they're just purely mirroring their race discipline pretty much. And that's what I loved about it out there.
Yeah, more or less. And the speed sessions, a lot of the time we would go to the track occasionally, but actually, you know, there's only two tartan tracks in Addis, I don't think there's very many more in the whole of Ethiopia, so we wouldn't actually be able to get into the track on the in the stadium very often at all, because it was generally only the national team could get in there. If we wanted to go and train there, sometimes we could by kind of bribing the guard or like having a conversation with the guard. He would let us in sometimes at like 4 a.m. to train before the national team got there. And those sessions on the track would be a bit more specific, but normally it would be like go to a big field in up in Salta and just run like 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute efforts. So not measured, people just going more or less where they wanted to on the field, but kind of racing each other, I suppose, on those speed sessions. So the coach didn't have to tell them to go to run hard and run fast, because he knew they were going to do it anyway. So yeah. It didn't have to be that specific, I guess.
It's interesting you say that, because I think that resonates with a lot of what you wrote about in the book, in terms of that feeling off other people's bodies and the idea, I guess maybe explain to our listeners, if they haven't read the book, I guess, just about always running in like a single file line, or maybe in two abreast, and just how it was all about the footfall and things like that. I guess you can explain it yourself.
So the kind of part of the kind of mentality of wanting to be in the group was this idea that energy could be kind of shared between people in some way. So they had a belief about, especially running on the road, that it was quite a lot kind of more similar to how we would think of road cycling, or like a team time trial, I suppose, where everyone has to be very close together and in formation in order to kind of benefit from each other's slipstream and things like that. And so people would actually run, as you say, like in time their footsteps together in order to kind of create this momentum that was like the group rather than the individual. I think that's something that was really important for them on most of the training sessions. And then like the Wednesday was the one, and that was to do with kind of also about trying to protect energy levels, make sure that people were running as quickly as they could whilst expending as little energy as possible, and not, because people were quite worried about the fact that they were training so hard and the odds against success were so high that they had this kind of fear of burning themselves up, as they put it, training too hard, doing too much. So the coach was always trying to hold people back as much as possible by creating this sense of kind of group cohesion. But then on a Wednesday morning, which would be the speed session normally, that all went out the window, and he was like, this is where they have to learn how to compete and learn how to kind of to drop people and kind of to run hard. So it was constantly trying to get a balance between those two things of holding people back and letting them go when they needed to, basically.
Mm. You touched upon it slightly there with accessing a track, you know, at 4 a.m. in the morning and stuff. Talk about how hard it is for runners on the way up, not a member of one of these sponsored elite groups in Ethiopia. Because I'm sure like some sub-elite runners in the UK could resonate a little bit, but we think we've got it hard here, but these guys it's in the whole next level, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and increasingly, I think even more difficult, because the government of support has actually grown, and they've set up more and more training camps in rural areas.
Right.
So I think I talk about one of the guys, Asefa, kind of narrating his journey to get to Addis in the first place. And it's like a series of selection races at various different levels. So like he was in a training camp in the place where he grew up to begin with. And he describes getting like 80 guys on the track and then running a 3K race and being told that we're going to take the two best ones to the city that's like next closest to Addis. Basically, in the first year, he finished third, and then the second year, he makes it. But then you get to somewhere that's a bit closer to Addis, a bit closer to kind of the opportunities to get abroad and race. But you've then got to do it again. You've got to prove yourself again at that level to then get to Addis Ababa. So by the time you've got to the city and these clubs that are sponsored, that allow people to kind of run full time, you've already been through a couple of these selection processes, I guess. And it's really not easy to break in to get to the stage where you can go abroad. It normally means that you've got to produce a decent run in a domestic race in Ethiopia. So either the Great Ethiopian Run or the cross country race or something like that. And that's just so hard to do basically.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think there's a problem now, especially with the new shoe technology in road running as well, that's another thing that separates the ones who are already really good from the people who are trying to come up and prove themselves, because it's really only the guys who are sponsored by Nike and Adidas who have access to the new shoes in Ethiopia and probably Kenya as well. So you also have to beat the guys in Vaporflies in an old pair of shoes. So yeah, it's hard basically.
Yeah, it's a whole nother dimension. I think on a world terms, I think that's what's always made the East Africans almost so good, because they've just been so strong mentally, because, you know, the foundation of their sport over there is just so ruthless in selection policy. Like you say, I mean, we know their Olympic selection policy is, we look at it as a bit bizarre, that they're going to have like a, you know, a race at altitude. And if, unless you do it, you can go like the likes of Bekele could not be picked for the Olympics and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what makes them so good when they go to a world stage, that they're so confident, because they know the guys they've just competed with or beat, you know, there's not many better in the world than them. And they're constantly having to prove their fitness.
Yeah. It's almost the opposite of the way that we think about, you know, we think you run internationally. That's a step up from running on the domestic
team. There's this reverse.
Sometimes the guys would say, if you go to like one of the smaller races abroad, you've only got to deal with five or six Ethiopians. You've not got to deal with 50 or 60. So in some sense, it's easier when they go abroad, I guess. Not at the Olympic level and things, but...
European meets and world tours and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, the depth of something like the Jan Meda cross country, which I described, which is the national championships, or the Kenyan national cross country. Those races are almost harder to finish high up in than the world cross, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that made me laugh in, I can't remember what the phrase one of the athletes used. I think when you were talking to him about some of these races abroad, he said something like, there's five Ethiopians, maybe a couple of Kenyans, and the rest are just running for fun or running. Yeah. And these are like kind of your elite Americans, elite Europeans. And it's crazy. Do you mind talking about your experience of because you did the Jan Meda, how you pronounce it? Because you actually ran that yourself. Like how, just kind of explain to the listeners how that experience was of actually being on the start line with these guys.
It was a kind of a saga to get onto the start line in the first place. I had to kind of persuade the Ethiopian Athletics Federation to let me run. Because they wanted me to run the junior race, because they said that I said, you know, I've run 30 minutes for 10K. Can I run the cross country? And they said, well, you can run the junior race because you might just about be able to deal with this. But I was already, I think, how old would I have been? 27 or something. I didn't really feel right running the junior race. So I persuaded them. They let me run the senior race as long as I didn't get lapped. They said, if someone's going to lap you, you've got to drop out. Which initially I thought it's a 2K lap. It's pretty unlikely you're going to get lapped. But then I started doing the maths and thought, actually, it's going to be quite close. So I ended up running this race with the basically the intention of not getting lapped and being allowed to finish it. But I won't give away whether I actually did or not. You have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was fun. I mean, everyone set off at... everyone sets off essentially as it, like they think they can finish in the top eight, which is... to potentially give them selection to the African Championships. So it's just crazily fast at the start, and then people start dropping out basically when they realize that they're not going to finish in the top sort of 10 or something. But pretty fast.
So it's just like a raw, like, that's the kind of racing we do when we're kids, isn't it? You know, it's just like you don't even think about the miles ahead, you just think about the next 100 meters. And it's, they had, seem to have the similar mentality.
Yeah, and there's not really the same sort of sense of shame or anything attached to dropping out. It's just seen as the sensible thing to do if you're not going to do what you sort of set out to do on a particular day, I guess.
Yeah, let's talk about their mentality, like what you found about them sort of overcoming obstacles and constantly, like you said, these guys would constantly get knocks. In a sense, you know, they'd get beat up in races or they drop out. But let's talk about how they overcome these. And like you say, how they think about dropping out. They don't see it as a negative experience.
Well, so a lot of the time people would rationalize that in terms of kind of religious ideas about God having a plan for their running, but, you know, having a bigger idea. And, you know, you might need to drop out of one race in order for something to happen further down the line, basically. But there was a broader idea that kind of the important thing was kind of consistency and patience over a number of years. And if you were prepared to kind of do that, then what happens at an individual race is kind of a small problem that hopefully is just part of a process that's going to get you to where you need to be, I suppose. And that's connected to kind of Amhara ideas about kind of idyll, kind of chance, which I write about in the book, which is about kind of cultivating this particular disposition of kind of silence and patience and hard work and deserving that will eventually be rewarded by the coach or by the manager selecting you to send you abroad. So there's this sense that it can be a really long-term process. And people would say about Haile Gebrselassie that, you know, it was years before he managed to get to a race abroad. And you look at everything that he did, you'd assume that he just kind of burst onto the scene. But people say that that's not the case. It required a lot of years, and he's older than people think he is because of that and things like that. So people would have these ways of rationalizing it as this really long-term process, I think.
Mm. You mentioned that they're kind of their belief there. I was wondering, how much did your kind of belief in that, almost the magic of Ethiopia, how did that change? Like, were you able to almost let go of your own preconceptions and like own history and running in the UK? And was there a point when you're out there that you kind of thought, I'm almost there on this? Or did you kind of, do you think it's because they've never had that understanding of it from a more scientific perspective, that they believe in it so deeply?
Well, I think as a researcher, my aim was to try and sort of do things as close to the way that they were doing them as I possibly could. So even though I obviously had preconceptions about how to train that were based on sort of 10 years of being a competitive runner here, that I thought that might have got in the way a little bit of the way that I interacted with people in Ethiopia, but it didn't, because I was slower than everyone, more or less. So it meant that they still saw me as somebody who was learning and was kind of a beginner, and they were willing to teach me things. But I was always, my approach doing the research was always to say yes to things when people suggested training sessions that, you know, if someone said, we're going to get up at 3 a.m. and go and run up and down a hill, I'd say, even if I thought that that's maybe not the most sensible way of training, I would do it because it was important for writing the book. And I do see the logic of some of those things, like that you're cultivating this sense of sort of dangerousness, as they would put it. And you're sometimes doing training that looks a bit crazy because you're sort of working on your psychology more than anything else, you know, so that you can then go and stand on a start line and think, well, there's probably not very many people here who did hill reps at 3 a.m. basically. But I did get into that sort of that way of thinking, and it's quite a nice way of thinking in many ways, because it makes running more fun and more interesting to do those kinds of things. I found that my own running didn't necessarily improve immediately after coming back from Ethiopia. I think just because I was trying to keep up with guys who were much faster than me the whole time I was there, and I was kind of overtrained and things. Yeah. I think some of the stuff that I've learned, I've then sort of implemented later, and it has been good.
Do you ever find yourself in the UK thinking, "Oh, am I going to go do something crazy?" Or do you kind of settle into, I guess, more of your traditional routine?
Well, I've been very busy. I think that one of the things is that I had far more time to do the kind of really slow zigzag running and things like that in Ethiopia. And I started a new job in October, and it's been that thing where you've got an hour a day to get your training in. You kind of got to be a bit more businesslike about it. But when I've got the time, I do incorporate that kind of forest running and things like that into my training. And I think it's been one thing that is interesting is that that a lot of what an elite Ethiopian marathon runner does would be actually what we would describe as trail running, as opposed to road running. And that's something that I think is that everyone can kind of incorporate into the training a little bit more.
Yeah, like didn't they sort of like they'd run for hours, you know, 3 hours at a time, just, you know, obviously a really high elevation, but just up in zigzagging in forests. Like you say, a marathon run in the UK wouldn't dream of doing that.
No, and I think a lot of the running is also very, you know, the point of it is to make sure that you're not doing the same routes over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's something that like, so I fall into the same thing when I'm like, but haven't got much time when I'm here, I'll do the same runs over and over again. And that's just something that they would never do. The running in the forest is always a different route every time, and they could, whoever's leading will make it up as they go along, and that's a way of kind of making the time pass more quickly. I think that it's always got to be slightly different. Try to run on slightly different terrain, and also you're getting more variety by doing it that way, because you're not stressing your joints and things as much as if you're just running straight on a road. So there's that kind of reason for doing it as well, I think.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Now, one thing the Ethiopians do, which may surprise, you know, quite a few people, is the importance they put on drills and exercises.
Yeah.
It definitely surprised. I mean, I knew they sort of do, you know, sprints and stuff after a run, but the actual amount and almost intensity and the focus they put on drills and exercises. Just explain that for the listener a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think a lot of the time if you watch someone like Kenenisa Bekele run, it's easy to make that assumption that, you know, he's just born to run like that.
Yeah.
And therefore the explanation for his success must be something to do with genetics or just the fact that Ethiopians are just inherently better at running. Mm. If you go to Bokoji and you talk to Coach Sintayu, who coached him and Tirunesh Dibaba and a whole load of other people when they were kids, most of their training actually by time is drills, plyometrics, kind of a whole load of different drills that are to do with improving running form, and then loads of hill reps where they're mainly concentrating on the form and the style of their running as opposed to speed. And so what looks like this kind of completely effortless running style has actually been trained through drills for, you know, starting at quite a young age, really, for someone like Bekele, I think. And then they still do it. So like the warm up for a session on the road would be like 25 minutes of jogging and then, you know, half an hour of drills a lot of the time.
Mm. It's something which stands out when you watch, like, you know, Ethiopians, Kenyans, Africans run, is just their footfall.
Yeah.
You know, it's always spot on. And, you know, one could just put that down to, like you were just saying then, their years of drills and drills and drills.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I remember I bumped into Zane Robertson once at the track, and he was training with the same group as me. It was a later trip after I'd written the book.
Right.
And he did about the first 10 minutes of the drills, and then he was like, I'm just going to sit down and wait for them to be ready to start, because it's too much for, you know, if you've not been used to it.
Yeah.
He said he'd often, if you do all the drills, you're too tired before you've even started the session sometimes, so... that was like, yeah, that's interesting wake up. But a lot of those drills are also to it's all about kind of timing and rhythm and getting in tune with each other before you even start running. So I found it, that was one of the things I found very difficult, was learning Zane was actually very good at them, but for me learning some of the drills was very difficult, because they're actually quite hard to do unless you've got the kind of strength and flexibility to do them properly.
Wow.
Yeah, I think one of the things that stuck out to me, I think you mentioned in the book, you'd done a I don't know, two and a half or 3 hour run, and they started doing these drills, and you were kind of just completely knackered, and that made me laugh. And it's just the way you describe their attitude to training, and just they always seem to be happy and smiling. And I mean, you mentioned it earlier about how easy it was to almost, I don't want to say infiltrate, but how easy it was to kind of get in with a group of guys. Like how kind of open are they to people, like especially I guess foreigners, like to just hopping in with them?
Yeah, very, very open, really. I mean, when I first started, as I said, I just went to the forest and people wanted to run with me. It was like very easy. I did have there's a sports management company, Moyo Sports, who actually work with a load of the top British runners as well. But Malcolm Anderson, who's the director of Moyo Sports, he's the guy who has the group in Ethiopia who I trained with. So I had a connection to him. Mm. But, you know, a lot of managers would be, and coaches are very, very happy to have people go along and train with them. There's not really a great deal of kind of secrecy or anything around that. And it's just, yeah, it's the sense of kind of camaraderie and the kind of friendliness of the groups is really nice. It does keep you going when you're training.
Mm. It's mad when you think about it. Like if this was football, this is the equivalent of like Real Madrid, if you like. And you're able to go over there and just rock up and train, or it's the equivalent of like the England international football team. You know, you'd get nowhere near them. But these guys, they're just open to, you know, anyone to come over. Do you think, I wonder why, like more, like you say, if there's a connection there with Moyo Sports, I wonder, is there a reason, do you think, that more British people don't go over there? Or Europeans as such? We're starting to see it slightly more, I guess.
I think people just they seem to opt for the US like recently, like from what, yeah. apart from your Farahs and you mentioned the Robertsons, like people seem to kind of opt for the US.
I'm saying, like, given the fact that you can so easily hop in with like a very elite training group, I wonder if there's, you know, why we don't see more British guys go over there. Is it, have you got any thoughts?
I think people tend to go to Kenya just because you can, because it's easier in somewhere like Iten to go for a run straight from the door and be on those kind of red dirt trails that are pretty easy to run on and pretty familiar. In Ethiopia, you've got the kind of, you'd stay in Addis, but then these kind of long bus journeys to and from training that sometimes we would leave our compound at like 4:45 in the morning and get back at lunchtime. So it's, I suppose if you're like thinking about just purely optimizing performance, then Kenya is maybe or the US is a safer bet because you've also got more things that you're more familiar with and things. But if you're looking for, you know, to also have a good time and to see some stuff that's a bit more interesting and you know, run in some really stunning places, then Ethiopia would probably be a good option, I think.
What would be your advice if, you know, say like me and Ollie, for example, we want to go out there, what would be your advice for us? And like where to go? I don't know if you would know where to stay or like how to go about going out there, because it's not quite as, judging from like some of the stuff in the book as well, it's almost not as safe as, you know, places that we would be used to, you know?
I think, well, My experience of living in Kotebe, which is like the suburb where a lot of the runners live, was that it was very safe. I would be, you know, quite happy walking back from like a friend's house at 9 o'clock on my iPhone in the dark and not, you know, not be particularly worried. The roads are quite dangerous, I guess, like sometimes. But apart from that, I never felt like it was dangerous. And then, I think, as long as you were at a level where you could train, you could run fast enough to keep up with them for like at least a little while, I would often end up getting in the bus, because normally these long runs, the team bus kind of follows the runners, and then the coach will hand out water every 5K. Mm. So if you do get dropped, you're able to jump in the bus, basically. But as long as you're at a level where you're able to do at least some of the stuff, and I think most coaches and most managers would be willing to have people go along to training and just experience it. So I guess what I would do is probably get in touch with, you know, with Moyo Sports or with another one of the managers, or there's NGOs that work on it as well. So there's an NGO called Run Africa that organize for people to go out running. But it did, I suppose that would be more if you were just looking to experience running in the forest and things like that, not so much if you were trying to train at a really hard level for an event. So
yeah,
a few different options, but people are interested. I'm very happy to put people in touch with whoever.
Sweet, man.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sure a lot of people listening would be interested in that. So that's great. Yeah. You touched upon almost if you go to Ethiopia, you might experience more, like without like kind of giving away too much for the book. Cause I just want to say as well, like, I think Matt's the same, like just recommend to all our listeners that it's a fantastic read. Without kind of giving away too much, like what was probably one of the most crazy or kind of unheard of things you kind of noticed? Like, I know Matt's got a session that he, for him, was like crazy. What was one for you, like one of your key like experiences of seeing someone do a workout or something like that was just completely unheard of?
Oh, right. Yeah. Probably, I mean, I found that the sessions of like 4K reps with the 1K float is extremely impressive because they're running basically 206 pace at 2,300 meters. So that kind of thing was amazing. The one that stands out for me is a session by a guy called Walder Meskel Kostre, who is one of the quite early coach who coached Gebrselassie and then coached Kenenisa a bit. And it's really simple. You just get athletes on the track and that you try to run 16 laps at a set pace. And it's basically a pace that the coach doesn't think that you'll be able to hold. And the deal with the session is as soon as you fall off the pace, you're out, basically. But the story is that is about Bekele running 16 laps at 61 seconds per lap in Addis, which just sounds incredible. But apparently he did that before he broke the 10,000 meter world record. And that was when he knew he could do it. So it's an interesting mix, I think, in Ethiopia between this, like the running in the forest, which is sort of, usually people wouldn't run with a watch. It was quite, it was deliberately kind of this meandering kind of adventurous style of running where they would deliberately sometimes go and see where the hyenas were in the forest and stuff like that, a bit more playful. And then this real objective kind of set training on the track where it's like you run 16 laps at exactly this pace and you find out, you know, exactly how fit you are. So it's kind of balanced, I think, a lot of the time between like objectivity and kind of creativity and more kind of playful running, which I think seems to work really well for them.
Literally the session we had written down that Matt wanted to mention. I think for me it was probably the 5-week build-up, so he's for Rome Marathon. The guy's name's slipped my mind. But just that is, I think if you're a, I don't want to give too much away, but like if you're a European and you kind of like feel like you're out of shape and it's like you've got 5 weeks to go for marathon, you're probably like, well, like, no chance sort of thing. Yeah. But just the pure like volume and almost that belief that we've spoken about quite a lot, just from how you described it, just seemed ridiculous, really.
Yeah. That's a particularly kind of extreme example based on the fact that he'd been very disappointed by his previous two races and then let himself get a bit out of shape. And then found out he had a race. So because a lot of the time with these guys, like it's a bit unpredictable when they'll get a race because it's the manager who's in Europe or in America who's doing that work behind the scenes. So the very top athletes will, you know, Kipchoge, someone like that, he can pick and choose and really plan a program. But for some of the more kind of 210 type guys, they might find out that there's a marathon come up in China in 3 weeks or something like that. And you've just got to get in as best shape you can get into, or just make sure you're staying in pretty decent shape all the time, just in case an opportunity like that comes up. So you get these quite creative training programs when somebody realizes they've only got 5 weeks, like Bahanu, and he ends up running, you know, 2.5 hours most days. But that was, it was a pretty remarkable run, that one.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's just... look, sports scientists would probably have like a nightmare reading this book on some of the stuff. You've got, you know, one thing I noticed as well, because there's such long drives as well, like you,
you would go hours after, like you say, you do a long run, a 30K long run or whatever, and then you would go hours after, you know, driving back. And by the time you get home and actually have food, it would be, you know, 3-4 hours has passed. But they seem to manage fine. So do you, and obviously, like, you know, you would know the information, you would know the science behind it. So what's your, like, belief now? Are you a lot more relaxed on that side of thing? Or are you still under the assumption, well, maybe if they did were getting food in after, they would be even better?
I don't know. I guess you'd have to do some sort of experiment. I don't really know. But I think, yeah, they're much more relaxed about it. I think there's, like, there's something to be said for not being totally, for not worrying too much about, you know, not managing to get an energy drink within 20 minutes of training and things like that. But yeah, sometimes there's on one occasion, I think I described it in the book. Yeah, we went and did a 30K run and then drove back to the town, realized there was a race on in the stadium, and we just went. So we'd already been in the bus for like 2 hours. We then went and watched two back-to-back 10,000 meter races in the stadium in the sun without having anything to eat. And I was kind of like seeing stars by this point. No one else really seemed that bothered. So I guess, like, I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk, because I'm not a physiologist. I'm, you know, an anthropologist. I don't really know, but I assume that there must be something, you know, when you get to 40K in a marathon, if you're used to being able to go without food for long periods of time and continue to run in that kind of depleted state, it must actually be quite useful in some way. Sometimes, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, like, with like fasting before runs and stuff, they say it's a good way of, like, utilizing your fat a lot more than usual. So, but yeah, like that was fascinating to me, how relaxed they were on sort of like the drinking and eating post runs and stuff. And they would still just, and it wouldn't affect them, like, they're still able to train at such, like you were saying, at such a high intensity week in, week out. But what is the food like out there? Is it very, I mean, you know, we just presume it's super healthy food, but you did highlight that it's not, you know, there are athletes who would go on like an unhealthy binge, if you like. So it's a little bit of a relatable.
Yeah. Sometimes. I think, yeah, the diet thing's really interesting, because a lot of the guys who I met in Bukoji said that they struggle when they move to Addis, because when they were in Bukoji, they'd never eaten anything that was grown more than about 200 meters from their house. So, you know, they've got, you know, incredibly, just
fresh.
They're eating teff, which is the great Ethiopian grain, which is very high in iron. And then, yeah, all the food is kind of organic, local, must be pretty good. And then they moved to Addis and they've got to adapt to that and buying food in the market and things, which is a bit different. But you've also got the religious beliefs, which mean that they will fast for a certain number of days a year, most athletes, which basically means that you're vegan for a certain, for like Lent, for example, you'd just be eating a vegan diet. But then they'll eat a lot of meat during festivals and things. So it's kind of the diet is not always to do with performance running, but it's also sometimes to do with other kinds of beliefs, I guess. But yeah, the fasting thing is interesting, because they often during that fasting period they also don't eat until 3:30 in the afternoon anything.
Wow.
So normally if you were training for a marathon, you would not be as strict as that, but that's what a lot of Orthodox Christians would do and have been used to doing. So
it's interesting, because it almost kind of mirrors their view on running. In a sense, it's kind of this, it might not be optimal in a sports scientist's mind, but I guess in terms of their own personal belief and how much they buy into it, it's the same as they want to run in the same air that Ken and Issa did, just like they'll eat because of their religion, and that's so important to them, and that will almost carry them for a race irrespective of whether they're fueled correctly.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think I wrote in the beginning, in the first chapter, that it's almost like, you know, lung capacity is important, but this capacity to believe in yourself and kind of cultivate this system of beliefs is also just as important. But I think if you wrote down a training program and a week of food for the average Ethiopian runner and gave it to a sports scientist, they'd say it's pretty good, pretty close to what you'd be doing, even if it's developed in this slightly more intuitive way. And most of the top Ethiopian coaches have also done masters in sports science. You know, Messeret, the coach in the book, he'd gone to university in Delaware and done a master's in sports science. So the ideas from sports science are there. They're just other ideas as well floating around that people can kind of pick and choose between different sorts of ideas and ways of approaching things.
I guess just before we kind of get towards wrapping up, have you got any picks for Ethiopians coming through, or I guess a good book when you were out there, it was a few years ago now, but was there kind of anyone you see coming or you probably saw coming who maybe has performed recently?
More recently, less so, but like while I was writing the book, Jamal Yima, who ran the Ethiopian record 58:33 for the half. Mm. When he first arrived in the training group, it was quite clear that there was something kind of different about him, and that he had something special going on. And I write about him quite a lot in the book. Mm. At the moment, it's quite difficult to predict who's gonna turn up. And I've not been back in Ethiopia for about a year, obviously with COVID, so it's a bit more difficult to predict. There's another anthropologist, Hannah Borenstein, who's at Duke University. She's in Addis at the moment. She'd be the one to ask for current picks.
We usually only see these guys on TV, you know, or we'll see them flash by in a marathon. But just give like a little bit of an explanation to the listener of like what they, because you, that Jamal Yima you just mentioned as well, in a book you say he was 46 kilos. You know, this is a grown man at 46 kilos. Like these guys are just in absolute peak physical condition and prime. I think you even mentioned it yourself about how it was almost hard for you to even to relate, you know, what these guys would go through and how they would feel when they're running, because, you know, they're doing 58 minutes for a half marathon and they're in such good physical condition. So, yeah, if you could just explain a little bit like what that was like seeing them, you know, every day and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, watching Jamal train was always amazing because he just he's so light, and I watched him do a session of 300 meter reps one day, and it's almost like you can hardly even hear him touch the track with the spikes. He's you know, there's a range of weights for the top Ethiopian guys, and he would be pretty much about as light as it gets, I suppose. Yeah. But what I think I was trying to get at in the book is just that I'm curious about whether, for me, running sort of 66 minutes for a half, which is probably quite close to what I'm capable of physiologically or whatever, does that just feel the same
as I've always wanted
to, like, for him to run 58, or does running 58 feel like this completely different, transcendent, amazing experience, or is it for him just relatively normal? That's kind of, and I don't think there's any way to answer that question. It's just something that I find interesting to think about.
Yeah, it's like if we could go inside another runner's body, we'd love to see, you know, are they as tired as me? You know, like when you're in a race and someone's pulling away, you're like, well, are they feeling good or are they working harder? You don't know, do you?
It's great to know, like, how does it feel to run 12:35? Joshua Cheptegei made it look like it wasn't that difficult, so it would be amazing to know what that felt like for him. But I think these are things that is very difficult to explain, and, you know, using language, it's kind of an embodied feeling, isn't it? And it's almost impossible to describe, but
yeah, interesting. So if you had one piece of advice for a European, you know, runner or a UK runner to try and improve, what would it be? Like, what's the one piece you've took into your own running you sort of value the most out of studying the Ethiopians?
I think the thing I would say would be to try to get off road as much as possible. That would be like a big takeaway from Ethiopia, but also to just you know, really take seriously the idea that you need to try to make things as creative and interesting as possible in your training. So they, you know, even though these are guys who are trying to change their lives through the sport, they're motivated by, you know, huge amounts of money that they can potentially make. They're also aware that running can be quite boring. You know, they say, even with football, you've got a ball to chase, you know, there's something there. With running, you kind of have to create the interest for yourself. And so they're quite conscious about making sure that they do that, whether that's by, you know, going to stay with somebody else the night before a run to run in a particular place, or whether it's like you're feeling a bit stale, so you decide you're going to get up at 3 in the morning and go run up down the hill to kind of you know, reawaken that kind of love for running or whatever. Just like seeing that as quite a conscious process, I think is quite important. Trying not to get stuck in a rut, I suppose, with the running.
Yeah, no, that's sound advice. That is, and I think it's something which almost as we get better in this sport, as we get older, that's probably the one thing we probably forget about.
Yeah, totally. And I think you've got to, I suppose, as you get older, like for me, I don't know whether I'll ever get back to sort of 220, but you kind of, your reason to run has to kind of change a little bit sometimes. Kind of got to think of new motivations, new reasons for doing what you do. And yeah, I think that's quite important.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mike, thanks so much for coming on. Just before we finish, do you want to kind of like shout out a book and where people can get hold of it? Because I'll definitely recommend it.
Sure. So today, 12th of April, the bookshops have finally reopened. So you can actually go and buy it in an actual bookshop, which would be great. Otherwise, obviously, it's available on Amazon, on Waterstones website, anywhere like that. But yeah, if you've got a local bookshop, then get out and try and support them if possible.
Yeah, I mean, out of thin air, I absolutely loved it. I'm not really, I don't read heaps, but I mean, I finished this book in a couple of days, and that's a huge achievement for me. It just gets you hooked. And if you have any interest in running, then I would totally recommend it, because these are the elite of the elite, the best in the world, if you like. And there's so much to be learned from it. But also, it's just such an enjoyable book, because it's almost like a story as well. You know, every chapter is like a new crazy run or a new crazy idea. You're like, oh my God. Yeah. So it is a really good book. So I recommend it for everyone.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed the podcast this week. If you did, please leave us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service, as it really helps us out. As always, if you've got any feedback about the pod, please tweet us at Sunday Podcast or send us an email to info@sundaypodcast.com. Also, we're very pleased to be able to announce that for next week's podcast, we spoke to Team GB marathoner Steph Davis. We spoke to Steph about booking her ticket to the Olympics this summer and much more. Catch you next week.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.